Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We've come now to chapter 8. David reigned over Israel for 40 years. Let's remember that the accounts of the events of his reign are selective. The narrators select materials according to their purpose. God is the protagonist in all this drama, and the Spirit of God, of course, guides the authors of the material. David is just the supporting actor in these narratives, so to speak. David is one of God's instruments, a very important one, but one of God's instruments in furthering God's redemptive purpose through his chosen nation. Israel was God's chosen instrument to be a channel of salvation to the whole world. David, remember, is a type of Christ, a pattern of Christ. Christ will conquer the world and reign over all of God's enemies. David was a conqueror. Of course, David's not a perfect type or pattern of Christ because, unlike Christ, David is flawed like the rest of us, and he will come up sadly short on occasion, as all of us do. But on balance, David was a great king. He was a godly man. He was a just king, a righteous king, upon whom the Spirit of God rested. And his conquests of God's enemies is a type or a pattern of Christ's universal conquest of God's enemies in the end time. Now, what we have in chapter 8 is a redundant illustration of verses 6 and 7 in chapter 8, where we have the statement, "And the Lord helped David wherever he went." That is the larger point of this narrative in chapter 8. When God is helping us, protecting us, there is no stopping us. When God's plan wants to give us success, all hell cannot prevent it. We will prevail. And if God wants to stymie our enemies, all hell cannot reverse it. Now, after this time it came about, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. David took control of the chief city from the hand of the Philistines. And he defeated Moab, which was on the east side of Israel, of the land of Canaan. He measured them with a line. He made them lie down on the ground, and he measured two lines to put to death, one full line to keep alive. And the Moabites became servants of David, bringing tribute. Then David defeated, as we move north, Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to restore his rule at the river, referring to the Euphrates River. David captured from him 1,700 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. David hamstrung the chariot horses, but reserved enough of them for 100 chariots. And then, still in the north, he took on the Syrians of Damascus, who had come up to help Hadadezer, the king of Zobah. And of the Syrians, David killed 22,000 men of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians were reduced to servants. They became servants to David, and they were bringing tribute to him, and there's the first. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. And then again in verse 14, and the Lord helped David wherever he went. Verse 15, so David reigned over all of Israel. David administered justice and righteousness for his people. Then we have a catalog of his administrators. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Zeruiah was secretary, the recorder. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. These were David's bodyguards. And David's sons were the chief ministers. In these narratives, we are seeing God fulfill his promise to David. We're seeing God establish David's kingdom, just a very sketchy account of the extension of its boundaries to the limits promised Abraham in Genesis 15:18. The scope of the territory promised to the patriarchs under the Abrahamic covenant is reiterated many times. For example, see Exodus 23:31 and Deuteronomy 1:7-8 and elsewhere. In this chapter 8, 2 Samuel, the author narrates briefly David's conquest of many enemies surrounding Israel, surrounded on three sides. These enemies, had not God helped David wherever the king went, would have thwarted God's plan. Kind of reminds us of what Israel is up against today. But by the Lord's help, these hostile nations were reduced to tributaries. And that's the theme. The Lord helped David wherever he went. What we need to understand here in this brief historical narrative is that David's subduing of the enemies of God and of his people in his day sketchily anticipates the subduing of the enemies of God and his people in the end times, when the Messiah, the Christ, the greater descendant of David, returns from heaven, judges the nations, and ushers in on earth the true kingdom of God. So, in this chapter 8, there is a typology, a foreshadowing aspect of this chapter. Just as in that day Israel was surrounded by bitter and oppressive enemies, and when the time came, God used David, his then earthly king, to subdue them. That is a pattern for that time when, in a global and final way, the Messiah will inherit David's throne. And at that time, the Messiah will conquer and judge all God's enemies and the oppressors of his people the world over. So what we see in this chapter is just a little foretaste of what will happen in the end. The theme of the first 12 verses of this chapter, some of which I read, and which catalog the conquest of David and the expansion of his kingdom, the theme is, as I've said several times, the Lord helped David wherever he went, verses 6 and verse 14. In expanding his dominion with God's help, David is fulfilling the promise of God to Abraham. When back in Genesis 15:18, the Lord told Abraham, quote, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the Euphrates. Now note this. In David's time and in the time of Solomon, God caused Israel's sway to extend down to the river of Egypt to the south, and all the way up to the Euphrates River in the north. Now their control, Israel's control of that territory, did not endure. It did not last. But the Lord made his point in the time of David. He is faithful to his promises. And eventually, what was only temporary in terms of Israel's boundaries will be made permanent when the Messiah returns. Today, everybody in the world seems to be demanding that Israel retreat into a narrow enclave of land that Israel occupied before the 1967 war. Now, I do not know how things in the near future will play out in the Middle East and with Israel. But if I understand the scriptures correctly in terms of God's promise, there's always the chance that I don't. But if I correctly understand the scriptures in terms of God's promises, then at least when Christ returns, Israel will own not only the Sinai Peninsula presently held by Egypt, but also Syria to the border of the Euphrates. God is not going to let his territorial promises to Abraham fail, and he's not going to allow them to fail for his name's sake. Of course, I can't say when it will happen exactly. I can't say how it will happen precisely. But if I am understanding God's promises and prophecy correctly, I can say what will eventually happen. God will give Israel every square inch of territory he promised to Abraham. Under the Messiah, the enemies of God's people will be subdued, and God's people will occupy a much enhanced territory. These conquests of David, who is the type of his greater descendant, the Christ, I reiterate, are just foreshadowings or types themselves of the judgment of Christ, the David of the end times, upon the nations of the world when the Messiah returns in glory and will reward his people, which will be not only the redeemed remnant of Israel, but the church amalgamated with them. One flock, one people of God. The Philistines were historic enemies and oppressors of Israel from the times of the judges, with their five chief cities and five kings, Gath being at this time the most prominent, apparently. The Philistines are mentioned first as among those David subjugated. In the process, he broke their back, and David delivered Israel from a perennial and vicious enemy lying along the southern Mediterranean border of Israel. Today, that territory is occupied by the Palestinians. Listen to this. We get the word Palestine from the word Philistine. Did you know that? That's ironic, isn't it? One day, those enemies will be no more. In fact, just as today when Israel is surrounded by enemies on every side, so it was when that nation was hemmed in by hostility in the time of David. And that, by the way, is much like the church in the world today. Israel is also a type of the church. The church, a spiritual entity, is surrounded the world over by spiritual hostiles animated by Satan. The Messiah will subdue them also. Despite the fact that on occasion Moab had given refuge to David and his family, in general, the Old Testament portrays Moab in a bad light, as a very envious, very treacherous, very proud and hateful enemy of the Israelites. When the prophets talk about God's judgment upon the nations, Moab, among others, is always singled out for prophetic mention as a target of divine judgment. And here, as we see in verse 2, David had to subdue the Moabites, even though at one point they had sheltered him and his family. Moab had been particularly vicious toward Israel at various intervals. On the occasion described here in verse 2, David made an example of them. After defeating them, David did an unusual, some would say, an atrocious thing. David decided to greatly weaken them for a long time. He did them by decimating, we presume, their captured fighting force. He measured by line their fighting force in three lines. Then it appears, if we're understanding the text correctly, he executed those in two of the lines and spared those in the third line and made them slaves. This was for shock value, I take it. War was brutal and bloody in those days. Although we can't say for certain, one way of looking at this, by the rules of hostile engagement that prevailed in those days, is that this might have been more merciful than usual in dealing with the enemies in that period. By the rules of war in that time, enemies who resisted an invader from behind their city walls, they were summarily put to death when at last they were overcome, whereas those cities who peacefully capitulated were treated more mercifully and simply enslaved by the victor. Warfare is always ugly and cruel in any day. But in those days, it was very, very cruel and a shocking proposition. We have to judge what seemed to us as atrocities by the rules of war at the time, not by modern standards. War is a great evil at any time. But the sinfulness of mankind, the utter criminality and rapaciousness of so many tyrants, especially at this time in history, where absolute monarchy was the norm and where the rule of the survival of the fittest was every day in play, rendered war an inevitable and constant evil in the race of man. Not only inevitable, but a virtual staple of the life of nations, as aggressors were always trying to take, and others were always arming up to defeat them, or taking preemptive action to prevent hostile action against themselves. Conditions were such that war was not only very up close and personal in those days, but as I said, very bloody, and in dealing with the civilian population, plus the conquered armies, to a certain extent those were one and the same, except for women and children, there were in those days, folks, no infrastructures to deal with the displaced, except slavery for the able-bodied, and the remainder were taxed into poverty, tribute. Then, too, in those days they ruled by fear, and harsh and cruel measures were instruments of choice to make would-be enemies think twice and three times about taking up armies against victorious kings. David in his conquest played by the rules of the day in many ways, but remember this. David, as we know from other military actions, did not act as a free agent. Rather, David sought the Lord's direction, as he did in the case of the Philistines. Remember 2 Samuel 5, 18-21? David in all his military actions showed dependence on the Lord, which pleased God. We can assume that such submission of his military actions against these other enemies of God and his people were God-directed. David was God's agent in punishing these nations. We're talking judgment here. In this case, God made an example of the Moabite army. He forced the fighting men, we presume, to lie down on the ground in measured lines, executing two lines, sparing the others, and then subjecting Moab to tribute that enriched the treasures of the Davidic kingdom. Remember, too, that David is not acting as the leader of God's people out of hate and bloodlust. But as I said, he's acting at God's direction, based on his previous example. And he's acting with God's blessing, as we see it. See verses 6 and 14, remember? And God helped David everywhere he went. David is not a fire-breathing, rabid vigilante. He's taking preemptive action against God's enemies and Israel's. David is, I remind you, God's instrument in fulfilling God's promise to Abraham. And when God goes into judgment mode, it's not a pretty thing. In the context of the times and their own accepted rules of engagement, David was doing what was expected, and perhaps, judged by those standards, doing so mercifully, or so I believe. But if not to be interpreted in that way, mercifully, David had God's help in battle against all these enemies, as the text says, and that help would not have been enjoyed if David, acting as God's approved prince, had been acting with vicious malice and murderous indifference to what was right and just. No, providentially, God was judging Moab through David, just as in the end times God will be judging the world through Messiah, and that will, as I said, be a bloody affair, but one entirely just, in that the wicked, like these Moabites, of whom the wicked generally are types, should be punished severely for their opposition to God and his people. Now, that answer I've just given will not appease the so-called moral objections of modern skeptics. But these are people, the skeptics, who do not know God, who do not know diddly about God's holiness, who do not care about honoring God, nor see the gravity of the sin of the wicked. They only care to see God's sins, so-called, and the supposed sins of his servants outrage them. Frankly, I'm of the opinion that human beings deserve whatever punishments God orders, because we human beings are all ruined and bankrupt from birth. Whether we're willing to acknowledge it or not is irrelevant. If God has no problem with David's war actions, neither should we. And there's no hint that he did in this chapter. End of story, as far as I'm concerned. Will the judge of all the earth do evil? Answer, no. Whatever God does or directs to be done is right. Because by definition, God in his character and actions defines good and evil. Let God be true, and every person who contradicts him be considered a liar. Well, as the narrator continues to relate the God-blessed expansion of the Davidic kingdom, in verse 3, he looks northeast toward Syria and beyond the Euphrates River. Located in that vicinity was a powerful and aggressive kingdom that posed a military threat to David. It had to be subdued for safety's sake. And it was exactly what David undertook to accomplish with God's help. The exact geographical sites of some of the place names in this narrative cannot be pinned down definitively in every case. But the general area is clear enough, running northeast of the Sea of Galilee toward the Euphrates River. We don't have to get tangled up in scholarly disputes about geographical sites. What we do know is that the rulers of these territories were no pushovers. The Promised Land, as anyone knows who's traveled Palestine, is very mountainous right down its spine, with only a few exceptions like the famous Valley of Jezreel, where the Battle of Armageddon, according to Revelation, will be fought. In ancient times, before Palestine was eco-ravaged by one war after another, it was richly forested. I mentioned the terrain to point out that the topography was not ideal for chariot warfare in most parts. Israel's adversaries on its frontier, however, to the north and northeast, majored in chariot warfare. It may strike modern sensibilities as animal cruelty when we read David hamstrung or lamed the chariot horses of Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, reserving only enough of them to draw 100 chariots of his own. But again, one must remember that this was war. Foul times require foul measures, as we see exhibited all too obviously in modern warfare, fought by different means, but horribly destructive all the same. If David left those well-trained horses alone, they could be used again and again for chariot warfare by their adversaries, and they would have been. This action degraded the ability of hostile kings and kingdoms to recover militarily when David returned to Jerusalem. Today we have mechanized weapons, gas-powered, or diesel-powered, or whatever. You can't leave those behind when you pull out. Unfortunately, in those days, warfare required not only men, but animals as well. And those animals presented a danger to the security of Israel. As unfortunate a choice as it was, they did what they had to do. Just ask yourself, under the same circumstances, what choice would you have made in that case? Again, in this evil world, war may be a necessary evil. Despite those naive idealists who just think that if you just lay down as a nation and refuse to fight, no enemy will take advantage and will decide to roll right over top of you and pick your bones. How stupid. And if it is necessary so that a government may protect its land and citizenry, not to mention the government itself, then it's going to come at a high price to the combatants. But the alternative is worse yet. So we live in a different world in many ways. We compare apples to oranges in many respects and come to absurd conclusions. Once more, if God is not objecting, explicitly or by implication, then neither should we. What had to be done, foul as it was done. It's funny, isn't it, how skeptics can pick at the morality of God's ways and His servants in dealing with their enemies. But no whimper about the unimaginable evil of destroying unborn baby by literally the millions. You talk about moral hypocrisy. There it is. Well, these military exploits of David, as we see in verses 6 and 8, the Lord helped him wherever he went, resulted in the enrichment of David's kingdom and the exaltation of David as the most powerful monarch in the whole region. David succeeded in whatever he undertook in the same way that any believer succeeds in whatever we undertake, not because we're so talented and smart, but because God, in His grace and for His own reason, sets His favor upon us and helps us in whatever we do. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.
Be sure the word gets in there.